I'd like now to welcome Nathan Duell. He is author of the new book, Friday Was the Bomb, 5 Years in the Middle East. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much.
So you lived with your wife, you and your wife lived in the Middle East. You live in Saudi Arabia, in Turkey, in Lebanon. She was reporting for NPR and was continually in war zones. She was in Iraq and Syria. And your book offers us a perspective that we don't usually see in the news, namely the perspective of daily life in these places, as well as the kind of backdrop of these big changes happening in the Middle East. How did you come to write it? Was it kind of piece by piece?
Yeah, I mean, it seems worth backing up slightly. I was a longtime editor in New York at the Village Voice and Rolling Stone, and I kind of reached a level with Rolling Stone where I felt really disconnected from the writer I kind of always wanted to be. So one evening I quit, and I packed a bag, and I walked from New York City to New Orleans, which I know sounds totally crazy, but...
That's a long walk.
It was a long walk. It was about 30 miles a day. It took me about 5 months, and it gave me a lot of time to think.
Why did you do that?
Well, New York is a special place, but it's also a bit of an echo chamber. And especially Manhattan media, you can feel really disconnected from the real world and from, you know, things like using your body or being aware of, like, what the rest of America is up to.
Right.
And so I was very happy to very slowly make my way across a great deal of our country. And amazingly, my marriage survived it. And so Kelly joined me down in New Orleans. And for several months, it felt like this place we could maybe spend the rest of our lives. But, you know, Kelly, who had... kind of happily let her career kind of dwindle a little while I was in New York, it was her turn. She's like, you know, honey, New Orleans is great, but I'd love it if we could move to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, which is literally probably as far away culturally as you could get from New Orleans. You know, New Orleans, of course, being all about music and the good life and food and, you know, a fairly tragic mix of sort of races and classes. Saudi Arabia is this, like, fierce and largely misunderstood, deeply Islamic kingdom. And, you know, we were two of the first Westerners to be permitted to live there as journalists. Prior to that, to visit Saudi Arabia, you could only go for a few days at a time, and you'd have a minder. When we landed, we kind of looked around. There was no minder. So we just got in a taxi and, like, started living there.
Why did you choose Riyadh in particular?
Well, it's the capital, and it's, you know, it's a large, sprawling city, and it was going to be a great base of operations for us to kind of travel throughout the whole country and, indeed, pretty soon the whole region. We spent some time going to Yemen and a lot of times in and out of the United Arab Emirates, which includes Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And it was, you know, it was an amazing time because it literally every time we walked out the door, it felt like we were encountering a new story. Because it was so difficult for reporters to visit, let alone live there, we really every month it felt like we were contributing a fairly significant amount of new scholarship about this strange place. There wasn't a whole lot else to do, so we also got pregnant, and we had our daughter there, which completely, you know, elevated our stature there, because people are like, wow, you're going to have your child here? And you know, the three things that really matter in Saudi Arabia are religion, family, and shopping. And we're not particularly religious, and we don't like to shop, but the fact that we were having a kid there was very meaningful for people who live there. They really let us into their homes, and I think we were both really proud of the sort of people we became there.
It's interesting, because your book is full of details that one would probably not know otherwise, and one of them is that it's really hard to find a doctor in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, who will do natural childbirth.
Yeah, because, I mean, in a country that's, you know, it's sort of this schizophrenic place because it's deeply deeply traditional when it comes to, like, religion and the treatment of women, but they're also obsessed with projecting a sense of progress. Like, we are modern people. We don't need to, you know, do that historic practice of just squatting and a baby comes out. Like, let's use surgeries. So people would schedule their cesareans, like, hair appointments, you know, weeks in advance. It was just like, yeah, I'm going to have one of the 8 kids I'm going to have over the 15 years. I'll just cut it out because that's modern.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny what aspects of Western civilization other people are accepting and rejecting, and we ourselves are accepting and rejecting in this country.
Oh, totally, yeah.
So what was it like for you? I mean, you then were put in the position as your wife, Kelly McEvers, was working at NPR and making her way into war zones and things like that. And she produced a wonderful radio documentary, which people can listen to online, called Diary of a Bad Year, A War Correspondent's Dilemma. Meanwhile, you were a lot of the time staying home with your small daughter while she was out reporting in very dangerous places. What was this like for you?
Yeah, I mean, towards the end of our time in Saudi Arabia, and I should say in Saudi Arabia, we were kind of on equal footing. Like, I would go and report, and she'd watch Loretta, or she'd go and report, and I'd watch Loretta. But then my dad died very abruptly, and shortly thereafter, NPR offered her that dream job. You know, the problem is that the dream job was in Baghdad. So with our one-year-old daughter and my recently deceased father, you know, we had to face this situation where Kelly was going to move to Iraq and cover this country that meant so much to our nation for many years. And I was going to move to Istanbul to, like, raise our one-year-old by myself. And it was the hardest time of my life because I just lost my father and I was trying to learn how to be a dad myself. And at the same time, really, you know, whereas we used to be on this equal footing, Kelly became, you know, more and more brave and adventurous and accomplished. And I became quieter and more fearful and more sorrowful and worried. So I don't know how many of your listeners have lost a parent, but it, especially when it happens quickly and when they're young, it can be really traumatic, and it makes you, you know, kind of evaluate every day. And it was a fairly monstrous calculus that led us to conclude, yeah, it's a great idea for the mother of our child to be in a fortified compound surrounded by machine gun nests for her job, you know?
Right, right. One of the things that I think you portray very well in the book is the sense of worry and what it means to be worried all the time and what it is like to be in a place where that worry is justified.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, so I maybe wasn't the naturally most gifted father of a 1 and 2 year old child. So the way I sort of compensated for my frustrations, perhaps was to worry more and to, like, anticipate all the things that could go wrong. And of course, you know, it's one thing to worry about, like, what could happen in this public square in Istanbul where I'm alone with my one-year-old versus, like, imagining what's going to happen to Kelly, my wife, as she drives from Baghdad to Fallujah wearing, you know, a black robe and a black mask and black gloves with one finger cut off so she could use her iPhone. And, you know, the other thing that dogged me through a lot of this was the fact that any of my feelings were nothing compared to, like, the actual suffering of Syrians being, you know, bombed by their own government, or, you know, Iraqis driven from their homes by sectarian cleansing, or, you know, Yemenis looking at the smoking rubble of their home that's been incinerated by one of our drones, you know? So,
yeah, I mean, there's a kind of surrealism that one feels and that one senses that you felt when you were writing, which is, I mean, you're getting a haircut, you're visiting the site of a massive car bomb attack, you're worrying about your mother back home, and the kind of, like, sense of what is real in my life comes up for the reader, or at least that's what I felt you must be going through.
And there, you know, there were some really powerful gender dynamics at work too, because, I mean, I think, you know, for many generations, in the popular imagination, the war correspondent is a man, a handsome, dashing man, like, you know, sort of jetting off to the latest calamity with some, like, romantic scarf, you know, drinking gins and cheating on his wife, and maybe he remembers his kids' names. But, you know, here was the complete inverse. You know, it was my wife who was going and doing the risky, romantic globe-trotting while I stayed at home and, like, made a nice bowl of soup and, like, washed the cloth diapers. And, you know, so I, part of it was just this sort of like disorienting humiliation of being like a deeply uncool dude. You know, I mean, there was just no, I couldn't figure out how to see any glory in my side of the family equation.
Welcome to how women have felt for millennia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I had the baby blues in some ways, but I had the baby blues next to, you know, at the crossroads of civilization, at a time of more convulsions and more sort of historic bloodletting than ever before, the Arab Spring. You know, so here I am surrounded by these countries where people are rising up against dictators. They're literally taking their shirts off and marching bare-chested towards the gunfire to make their countries better. And I you know, at the same time, I'm feeling kind of trapped because the most important thing I can do that day is to, like, very patiently read a bunch of books in a soft, sweet voice to my, you know, sort of plump little blonde daughter. And I did it. Of course I did it, but I did it with a lot of feelings.
We're talking to Nathan Duell about his book, Friday Was the Bomb, 5 Years in the Middle East. Now, were you all this time writing? Were you doing some reporting yourself?
Yeah, I mean, in Saudi, the book is kind of in three parts, in the way in which my life was kind of three parts. Saudi Arabia, I was definitely working as a journalist. I was going out, asking questions of people, trying to understand concepts and problems and news. In Turkey, in the wake of my dad's death, and in the very sort of early dawning, this realization that I was married to this woman who was becoming the war correspondent she was born to be, I turned inward. I was trying to work through my own, what was happening inside my own head. And so those were, you know, a lot of garbage, but some of it started to take shape, these essays about grief and about worry and about longing. And then, after a year and a half of that, we moved to Beirut, which is allegedly going to be this great new move for us, because we'll live in this historic, beautiful city on the Mediterranean together. We'll be sharing a house. We'll be trying to figure out a country together again. The problem is that, you know, the violence starts coming closer and closer to Lebanon. You know, the sort of inspiring uprising in Syria that Kelly thought she was going to cover, you know, a la Tahrir Square in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya, you know, the situation in Syria was quickly becoming like a brutal civil war and a massacre on an unprecedented scale. So that sort of new life we envisioned became, you know, much more grim than we bargained for. So, yeah, by the time I get to Lebanon, I'm writing constantly, but I'm writing about things that are outside of my head. You know, the colleagues that start dying, the friends who go missing.
Right.
You know, the night that there was a 7-hour shootout literally on our block in Beirut, with, you know, soldiers rolling up in an armored personnel carrier and taking up position on our front steps and, you know, firing late into the night at bad guys.
And meanwhile, I mean, in that chapter, you are shielding your daughter and your wife is running out into the night to talk to people.
Yeah, it couldn't have been like a more kind of perfect distillation of the two very different people we'd become. Yeah, so when the pops of sporadic gunfire turn into like a constant deafening wail of machine gun fire, and then we start hearing grenade explosions, my instinct is to cower in front of our daughter's door, and Kelly puts on a helmet and grabs her press pass and like goes out to find out what's going on. And we had our roles, and you know we did them as well as we could, but towards the end I couldn't handle it anymore. I didn't want to lose her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the hours, again, I mean, this is one of those books where the reader imagines him or herself in your shoes a lot, and just imagining the hours between when she goes out the door with the helmet and when she comes back, I don't know how many hours later, is almost unbearable.
I mean, you know, I was proud of her. I'm still proud of her. I mean, she was really good at it. And, you know, Loretta would, our daughter would say, where's mom? And I'm like, well, mom tells stories. She's going out there to talk to people who are in trouble, and they have no one that will listen to them. And if your mom doesn't go talk to them and ask them what happened, no one will know. And Loretta's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, well, you know, some of them don't have shoes, or they live in a cave, or someone's trying to hurt them. And, you know, I mean, to express it very simply to a 3 or 4 year old is, you know, sounds sort of cheap, but at times it could feel kind of profound too. And I was quite proud of the work she was doing, but I think it was someone else's turn. You can only do it for so long until your nerves are shot. The nerves of your family, at least. I think Kelly would happily still be there if she could.
Now, there's a chapter where you set out to write about the contrast between the TV show Homeland, which depicts Beirut, and the actual Beirut where you were living, and then it turned out not to be the chapter that you had intended to write.
That's right, yeah. I'd gotten kind of ginned up an assignment with GQ magazine that this show, you know, fairly high-profile show is going to bring the location to Beirut. I didn't actually see the show before I pitched the story. I'm like, you know, I'm sure they got it wrong, and I looked it up, and sure enough, they make, you know, a street in Beirut that basically looks like Miami Beach. They make it look like a desert encampment under siege. And so I'm like, I'm going to correct the record. So I pick a day, I'm going to go out and show the really good life I have, the one I'm raising our daughter in, and sure enough, at 3 p.m. that day, there's a massive car bombing that, you know, levels a city block and kills the country's intelligence chief and 100 are wounded. And it's one of those moments when, you know, reality and fiction converge.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, it's a really slippery place, the Middle East. And I think it's easy to imagine it as this sort of monotone, gray place, but it's in reality 10,000 different towns and villages and cities, each of them different, some of them in the mountains, some of them by the sea, and I felt very lucky to have experienced them, and I miss it.
And one of the ways that you actually stayed sane was through yoga.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, when during the really the 2012 was the most violent year for journalists on record. And that January and February, we lost some really good, you know, members of the tribe, we call it. And I was just losing my mind. I couldn't stop having nightmares, and, you know, my heart was racing all the time. And, yes, I figured I'd try out yoga because, you know, I'd heard that it would make you calm. I'd heard that it would make you a better person. I'd heard that it would change your life. And sure enough, it did. For a while, it was great. And I was so happy to find something that had, like, rules and repetition and, like, this promise that if you just followed this path, things would get better. But sure enough, similar to that GQ story, it turned out my teacher had some, like, intense personal problems, and she had to leave abruptly. And so I found that even yoga would let me down. yeah, so I had to quit.
What was your perspective on the Arab Spring from a political perspective? I mean, you're looking at so much on the ground stuff like conflicts and bombs and fear and all of those things, but what about, did you have the chance to kind of take a step back and look at what this actually represented and listen to people's political perspectives?
Yeah, it did not come as a huge, you know, I mean, of course, none of us really expected something that huge, but the writing was on the wall. You know, when we were in Saudi Arabia, we were constantly hanging out with, you know, kids in their late teens, early 20s, 30s, more secular than their parents, more urbane, better read, more connected to the world through social media. Like, these kids are not going to take it anymore. So really what you saw in Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia is the rise of a youth movement that has changed the Middle East forever and will continue to change it. And it's exciting. I mean, it's going to be messy. You know, they say that, like, real democratic institutions, you know, they don't exist until you have two consecutive transfers of power from one democratically elected leader to another. Do I think that's going to happen in Saudi Arabia in 10 years? No, I do not. But it's coming. And it's a region we all need to keep watching. And, you know, I think there's lessons in it for our own country too. I mean, I think President Obama came in on a wave of youth support, and I'm looking for the kind of young people of our own country to realize how loud a voice they can have if they just use it.
Well, there were people who were making comparisons between the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street.
Sure. Too small. We need more.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking, you know, millions and millions of people in a, you know, in a country five times smaller than our country.
We're talking to Nathan Duell about his book, Friday Was the Bomb, 5 Years in the Middle East. Now, this whole question that your wife explored in her radio documentary and that the two of you were exploring together, namely, why do I do this work, putting myself in danger? Why do I do this work when I have a family, and particularly a small child? And then the decision to leave, which of course is a difficult decision, did you feel that that was her decision to make or yours to make together as a family?
Yeah, we had to all make it together, but ultimately it was on her. I mean, I had to give her the space and the time to come to the conclusion herself. And for any of your listeners who are familiar with her work, she's not your typical journalist. Like, she gets very personal and sincere on her reports. She often puts herself in the stories she's doing. And so it was like no surprise to anyone who knows her that, you know, kind of in the thick of this, when she realized that she was becoming really good at it, she started interrogating that skill she had. And ended up, you know, that documentary, A Diary of a Bad Year, took her a year to make. And the opening scene is her riding in the back of like a chopped down pickup truck, surrounded by guys with headscarves tied over their faces, everyone holding AK-47s, a 50-millimeter cannon mounted to the top, and they're all drinking Red Bull. It's 3 a.m. They're rebels in Syria, and they're driving on fast mountain roads towards the explosions. And Kelly's like, you know what? I love this. And so, you know, it's not a normal thing to love that.
Right.
And so she spent a lot of time thinking about it. She talked to other correspondents who are either still doing it or have left. She's talked to scientists. It turns out it appears that people who are attracted to these dangerous activities, this includes like adventure sports as well, they're not like us. They literally have a different brain chemistry than the rest of us. They thrive under this pressure, and they become addicted to it.
Yeah, they have, what is it? They have more dopamine or something.
Dopamine, that's exactly right. So, I mean, they're literally like, their bodies are built for this. And, you know, I think the part of the story that was most painful and led to her being able to walk away was she talked to the daughter of a slain correspondent. And she's just like, Kelly, you can pretend you're doing this to make the world a better place, but you're lying. Don't lie to yourself. Don't lie to your family. You're doing it because it's fun. And it is. It's incredibly fun.
Now, do you think so too? Do you experience it that way?
I mean, I became accustomed to the glory of it, the feeling of living on the sidelines of history. I mean, that was really fun. You know, to go out to dinner with the correspondents for the New York Times and CNN and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the Financial Times and BBC, and they're all like just back from Cairo or on their way to Syria. And, you know, these are the people writing the first draft of history and not the history of like Illinois, the history of the Middle East. You know, when you're there, nothing's more fun, and it's very hard to walk away from it. And we've got a lot of friends who are still there. And, you know, we live in Venice Beach now, in Southern California, and we're living a much different life now. And, you know, when things started to go down in Iraq last month, it was really hard for Kelly to hear and read reports from all of our old friends who are covering the biggest story there is right now at the time, and for us to be here. And, you know, I'm working on a story about homelessness in Venice, and, you know, Kelly's doing a story about, like, you know, economic inequality in Seattle. It's a different life.
Right.
But I think we're trying very hard to see how this life can be really meaningful as well. Because one of the things that I find most interesting is, as an expatriate, you're a ghost. You know, you're sort of gliding above it all. You know, in Istanbul, if there's some sort of big protest, you know, if there are a bunch of Turks raising their fists and I go and, like, raise my fist, they're going to look at me like I'm crazy.
Right.
Because I've got no skin in that game. You know, it's really exciting to be back in America where what I do matters. I'm a citizen. I'm a voter. Where I send my kid to kindergarten, that matters. That says something. And, you know, so I think maybe, you know, as parents and as writers and as thinkers and as citizens, we're maybe this next phase is we're not just observers, we're participants to the degree, you know, we're allowed to be. And Kelly is still an employee of NPR after all.
It's interesting. I've had people say, especially during certain parts of the Bush era, that if this country gets really bad, they're leaving. And I think especially if you are involved in the media, if things get really bad, that's the time when your country needs you the most.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't buy that really bad thing. I think that's cowardly and peculiar generally. But, you know, I mean, it's an interesting and valid response to, like, a government you disagree with violently. You know, I mean, America's, it's got a lot of different possible avenues for all of us, I think.
Nathan Duell is author of the book Friday Was the Bomb, 5 Years in the Middle East. And by the way, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 29th of July at 6 in the evening. Why should people pick up their phones right now and make a pledge to public radio?
Because there is no greater source of information than public radio. Not just information that will delight and entertain you, which it of course will, but the sort of vital, crucial, real information that will help you be a better citizen. Because you can't think and make decisions unless you know what you're doing. Public radio makes that possible.
Nathan Duell, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you next week here in Santa Fe.
It's a pleasure.